Hello, friends. Kyle Tierman here, and welcome to another episode of my podcast. Thanks for hanging out. Thanks for giving me your ears. Thank you for lending me your time and attention. I do not take it for granted. This episode is with Mark Healy. Mark Healy is a professional big wave surfer, spear fisherman, bow hunter, photographer, filmmaker, and part-time Hollywood stuntman. If you like this episode and you want to hear more, you can scroll back into the archives and listen to episode number 28 with Healy, episode number 152 with Mark Healy, Shane Dorian, and Jake Muse. That was a four-way. And episode number 158 with Mark Healy, Chris Ryan, and Ben Greenfield. So we got a lot of Healy on the mic, and I try and make a habit to get this guy on the podcast every 100 episodes or so, because he is one of the all-time greats. In this episode, we talked about big wave surfing, we talked about bull riding in Mexico, we talked about the birth of his first child, bow hunting strategies, breath control techniques, and brain health. Before we get this episode going, I want to let you all know about my weekly newsletter. Just once a week, I send an email with a question that I've been pondering, something I've been thinking about, something I've been chewing on. It ranges from snarky to earnest to, at times, deeply contemplative. But I find that questions are a great way to navigate the world, and if we all start asking ourselves better questions, we can find better answers. So if you would like to hear from me just once a week, you can click the link below this podcast, go to tierman.substack.com, give me your email, and just once a week, you will get that newsletter from me. If you haven't noticed, I've migrated this whole podcast over to Substack. It automatically aggregates out to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And I find that Substack is just a really great model to be able to get everything out at once, as well as bring you guys all over to that platform where you can comment on the episodes directly from Substack. It's where you can recommend new guests. It's where you can send your lovely hate mail to me and everything in between. I'm just a big fan of Substack, and I think it's one of the most exciting things going on the internet right now. And if the spirit moves you, you can become a paid subscriber where I deliver special content to just the select elite few that offer, I want to say it's $6 a month to become a paid subscriber, or if you're feeling super generous, $50 a year. It helps keep this whole project going. I plan on doing podcasts until the cows come home. And for those of you who get value out of this media and want to buy me the equivalent of a nice cup of coffee every month, I really do appreciate it, because it allows me to prioritize booking these interviews, prepping the questions, and then doing all the post-production, which I am doing right now. It's a one-man band, and for those of you who do support it, I feel very, very grateful. And final thing, if you want to send me voice memos, for those of you who listen but maybe have never reached out, just record 30 seconds to a minute of audio on your phone using the Voice Memos app. Let me know who you are, where you're listening from, something that you're looking at. If you're on the top of a mountain or at the bottom of an ocean, just let me know, and I will play it at the beginning of this podcast. You can email those to tierman@substack.com. Please just try and do stuff that's not promotional and more, shall we say, reverential towards the natural environment and the places that you love to listen to this podcast. And I would love to play it at the beginning of this show. All right, that's it for now. Hope you all have a lovely day. This was a fucking good podcast. Healy is fire on the mic. And please give it up for the one and only Mark Healy.
Kyle Cameron here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part about Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up. Thumbs up.
Let's start it with Morocco.
Okay.
Tell me about Morocco.
So I actually met Jerome Seyoun, who has the keys to Morocco, basically. He runs the show. He's like a Raimana type of character in Tahiti in Morocco. And I actually met him surfing Chopo on a day, and it was just me and Benjamin Sanchez, who's a friend of his, and maybe one other Tahitian guy out, and it got really good. So we started talking, and he invited me to Morocco. And I was like, okay, cool. Maybe it'll happen one of these days. And fast forward a few years later, and there was a pretty big swell lining up in the Atlantic that's going to put some surf to Morocco. I was with Greg Long, Ian Walsh, Alex Gray. Who else was there? I'm going to feel really bad.
Had you been to Morocco before?
No, I hadn't. It's my first trip there.
Amazing, amazing country.
It's so awesome. Yeah. And it was, I got in before everybody else. It was New Year's Eve. So I was like kind of in this big tent. Jerome, was somewhere else. So I was with his like crew of guys that they're literally traveling with like a convoy of trucks and jet skis and like a giant, like
I'm picturing like AK-47s and like, fucking fighter jets.
Probably. A giant tent that's almost like a circus tent, like a Moroccan style. And it's like set it up every evening and, you know, eat this amazing Moroccan food with your hands on a rug inside. Yeah. It was pretty awesome.
Tagines.
Yep, tagines. And the swell ended up being really big, but then another bigger one stacked up on top of it. So we stayed longer.
Were you guys surfing throughout that first swell?
We surfed all over the place. Oh. Like he runs such a hot program. You're going to like, 1 a.m. like just trying to get to the next spot to be on it at first light in the morning, like driving for 6-8 hours a day surfing or a night and then surfing all day long.
So you guys are getting big waves but also just good waves,
all kinds of waves,
yeah,
like slabs, barrels, points,
yeah,
everything. And then this one giant swell came and we were trying to get out early. I was honestly tired from the program we had been running. I think we're all a little bit tired. And I only had a 9.3 with me. The harbor, which is actually a very large port, like it receives really large ships, has a giant break wall, probably the biggest break wall I've ever seen, actually. And it was like a disaster zone in there. Wow. There's whirlpools in this giant harbor with like half sunken boats spinning around in them.
Yeah, because Morocco is such a an intersection of countries from Africa to Europe. Like that's, it's such a multicultural experience because you have so many people and things moving into Morocco as a nexus point. So I would imagine that that port would be huge.
Yes. Yes. That's a great way to describe it. But it, you know, full natural disaster mode, like wreckage everywhere. We couldn't get out until about, 11 a.m. I want to say. And then we had a ride down the coast and, It's kind of like it's very exposed, super far out to sea reefs that we went to, similar to Cortez in that like any kind of wind is bad wind. So to get humongous swells and have the wind conditions the way they are was really fortunate. But I saw a couple waves where we all saw a couple waves break on this reef that was like, it was the biggest waves I've ever seen in my life.
Really?
For sure. Only two broke. And
Were you with Hotman? Was Hotman there?
Yeah, Hotman was there.
So Hotman, I just posted a little Instagram thing of like, I'm interviewing Healy, and he said, ask him if Morocco were the biggest waves he's ever seen in his life.
It was. The two,
really?
Two waves that I saw were so big. Like,
so way out to sea?
In the middle of the ocean.
Okay.
And it for sure, 100 feet, for sure. And it's so hard to tell without scale, but you just kind of, after looking at so many giant waves over your lifetime, you can tell by how long it takes the wave to break.
Yeah.
It's just like in super slow motion.
The slower motion it is.
It was like a 5-second count for the lip to hit the water. It was insane. And then we surfed another reef and we were out there and I was like, I didn't really ever see anybody on a wave. We were trying to paddle. We're spread out. It's kind of like mixed wedge kind of reef. I'm like, it's top to bottom, like top to bottom barrels. And I'm pretty sure it's humongous. And I feel like I'm like the last sardine left over in a bait ball. That's about to, like the Blue Planet where there's just scales falling and you see the one limping sardine just gets wiped off the screen by a tuna or a bird or something. It was just dodging, not getting caught. And then I think I might have rode one wave, but later we saw a couple of pictures of the waves the guys towed in on, and you could see a person, and it was like, oh, that's easily a 70-footer.
Wow.
And it was significantly smaller in there than the ones that I saw out the back.
Wow. And was it a left or right?
Mostly a right, but it's peaks. Like, it would be highly unadvisable to go paddle around out there. Like I got really fortunate.
1 star on Yelp.
Yeah.
Not recommend. So when I went to Morocco, right before COVID, and I stayed with a guy named Saad Abid, who was very hospitable. And he kind of told me about that story and that wave. And it's a place that you don't necessarily think about to have humongous waves, but it's quite a country of surfing. And
yeah,
culture.
And that was like, that. What was it, like the Hercules? You know, they name all these storms, but that was, I think, the biggest North Atlantic swell potentially on record, like one of the top five ever since they've been tracking things.
Yeah.
And the wind was light, so who knows if that'll ever even happen again during my lifetime.
Right, right. Are you, do you travel less now than you used to?
I do. I travel way less than I used to.
And what's the criteria to get you on a trip these days?
Well, criteria, it's got to be productive. I'll do, you know, a handful or a few trips that are just completely like unproductive every now and then. Actually, less than a handful. Those are usually hunting trips, but right. I'm getting food. But yeah, I would love to go chase waves, but honestly, for me to go spearfishing or do a bow hunting trip, I can get that ticket covered way faster than a surf trip from the brands. I'm just not with surf brands. Besides wave riding vehicles, I'm not with surf brands.
Right. You've kind of migrated into hunting, no pun intended.
Well, I got very fortunate in that my passions ended up being, you know, popular and rising kind of, I don't know, I guess you'd say, I hate to use the word industries, but... yeah, it kind of always kept coming back and working in my favor. I looked at the surf industry. I'd been, you know, a student of it and watching and following and learning the business aspect of it. And I was just like, oh man, this thing's got one foot in the grave, the other in a banana peel.
That's great. Yeah.
There's going to be a big transitional moment. And you know what? I just kind of got sick of being on... Kind of having it's completely self-imposed, of course, that like being on the hamster wheel of like, I have to be relevant this week. So you're stressing out, like going for these swells, and you're like, God, I'm like, if I don't get like a standout wave on this swell, it's a loss, and then it's gonna be, this is all forgotten about next week. Like,
yeah.
I got to stay in this cycle of being on top of the heap consistently in big surf.
Yeah, it's like don't try and win the game, invent a new game.
Exactly.
You know, I think that I listened to Michael Pollan, the guy who wrote How to Change Your Mind about psychedelics. He's a very illustrious writer. And he said, when you write about a subject, a new subject, because he had never taken psychedelics in his life, I believe, before writing that book, and now he's kind of an expert on the subject. And he said, a lot of people become experts in a subject for too long a period of time, and then they forget what it was like to know nothing about the subject. So they become bad at explaining it.
Right.
And as I've watched you get into hunting, it seems like it's still new enough that you're excited about it and can actually explain shit better than a lifelong hunter often, because you remember what it was like to know nothing. Like, you're able to draw analogies and draw it back to the ocean, which provides a great service for a lot of people who are in this industry and just want to know more about it.
I think you're definitely correct in that sense. It's still, I first picked up a bow probably 12 years ago, but it's still so fresh. I still love the whole experience and the new places I get to see and be a part of and take more responsibility of with my food and the stuff that I feed my family with, and be able to be like proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like because we do so much complaining about all the parts of our system that are broken, which there are many and they're worth complaining about. But until you take like personal action, that's all it is, that you're just blowing smoke.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to have like certain areas where I'm like, okay, you know, I'm not just bitching about like all the processed foods and chemicals feed my daughter. Now I know I'm participating and hopefully giving her a healthier option.
Yeah. Who's been a hunting mentor of yours?
Hunting mentors have definitely been like Dave Wassel and Shane Dorian are guys who like really were on me to get into bow hunting.
They were into it before you.
They were into it before me. So they really lit a fire under my ass, because I was like, how fun can it be? Yes, I like the idea, but I got to like make the time, and we don't have like bears and stuff to be scared of in Hawaii. Like, that doesn't sound that exciting to
just,
me.
Just going on a hike.
Yeah, hiking in camo. Once I got into it, or went the first time with Wassel, and I felt that like crazy amount of adrenaline and just being such a novice at like cleaning and preparing this pig. I was like, oh gosh, there's so much to learn here.
Yeah. And it opens up your cooking possibilities endlessly too, which is like such a big part of life. Like, it would be hard to, your wife eats meat, I would imagine.
Yes.
In a massive, like, could you be with her if she was vegetarian?
That'd be very difficult.
Like, a lot of what you're doing, I've had the thought that like half of all relationships are physical in some sense, like physical in that you're eating food, or it's about like touching each other, or it's like about like the human animal doing things rather than just talking at each other.
Yes.
Which is like, I mean, that's a huge amount of it. And if you're only thinking about like, well, we have great conversations, which is important too, you're missing three meals a day, which could be a conflict, three meals a day.
Yeah. And if you just take into consideration how much body language plays a part in our communication, like technically that's physical because you're not speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's all these different cues, and whether it's like intimacy and touch or breaking bread together, those are just huge parts.
Right.
I think we fool ourselves and think they're not as big as they really are, especially because we're so confused all the time by just doom scrolling on social media, and our brains are everywhere. We don't know.
What do you think?
We don't appreciate the things that are affecting our
right. Wait, our you think we're confused about what?
Just the inundation of information.
Right. Yeah, our brains can't take it.
We don't like. It's hard for us these days to take thoughts and fully form them from beginning to end, because it's on to the next shiny object.
Sure.
I know it's definitely that way for me. I see it. It changed me, and I'm probably like on some kind of ADD spectrum, because that's the way I've kind of always been.
Hmm.
So it's probably not the best thing for me, but I'll catch myself and I'm like, God, I'm doing it. Taking the bait again.
Right. Right. How do you, this is interesting. I like conversations about metacognition and like thinking about thinking. How do you, how do you find that if you're in a skitzed out space, you can deprogram yourself and actually get into a high level of thinking to do something that could potentially kill you? And I'll just give you kind of like an example of like ways that this can go. Like, I found myself before big wave surf sessions doom scrolling to kind of like not think about it a little bit. And then I'm like, this is like the worst space that I could be in. And then you finish the big wave session. You're like, maybe I should do doom scroll some more because maybe someone got my wave. And then you're like in this creedled out, like cracky state of wanting more dopamine. You
just bookend every experience totally. With doom scrolling.
But like, how do you have any systems or protocols or mindfulness practices to get yourself in a state where you can perform at a high level in a potentially life-threatening situation?
I like to do a breath hold, or at least my breathing warm-up routine, because I'm so used to, I think not only does it bring your heart rate down, it's going to bring anybody's heart rate down once you start holding your breath and you work your way into that breath hold. But it's such a physical cue for me at this point in life. I've been doing it since I was before I can remember, you know, with free diving and everything. So it's like, as soon as I do a first breath hold, it's like my body just knows, okay, it's time to focus.
Mm.
So I even do that in hunting situations. And I've asked, I think I was talking to Huberman about it. He's like, okay, so we're talking about the adrenaline aspect of bow hunting. And I was like,
were you on a hunting trip with him?
No, I was just talking to him, for a book he was writing.
This is Andrew Huberman.
Yeah. And, I was like, okay, so this is the interesting thing. So say if you just did a 2 hour long crawl on your belly, you know, to stalk in, cause that's how it happens sometimes with this bow hunting situations, especially in Hawaii, you do a lot of crawling. But you're tired because it's kind of like doing like a plank for the whole time. Like your abs are smoked, your arms are smoked, and now you got to get up in like a very controlled way at just the right time and draw back and be steady. And it's like you've invested so much time into this stock, and it might be a high intensity situation that your adrenaline is like, you can tell that looking through that peep at your pins that are telling you your yardage that you're putting on that animal, that doesn't lie. And you can see it bouncing with your heartbeats. So to calm myself in those situations, I was saying, it's like, it's not like box breathing or anything. I'll just do like a 1 minute breath hold before I know I have to get up and draw. The box breathing, I can kind of bring it down, but if I do a breath hold, it like forces me to punch through that initial anxiety of, you know, when you get far enough in the breath hold to where it's becomes difficult and you have to make the decision whether to relax into it or try to fight it. And if I get past that point and relax into it, it clicks something else over. So that's what I'd do like before a big day if I'm feeling kind of shitty or in a bad headspace.
Where do you first feel the discomfort in a breath hold in your body?
Usually in your diaphragm. You know, that's where it builds up. The same place that, like, if you get really horrible, tragic news or something, it hits you right there. You know, it seems to be like a neural center for emotion and that fight or flight aspect of things. Usually when things hit you there, it's not necessarily positive.
Do you have a first thought that comes in when your diaphragm starts to spasm? Or a sequence of sentences that you'll then tell yourself?
So what I like to visualize is, because you can feel it, it's almost like a simmer coming to a boil. You know it's coming. And that can really get in people's heads, and people really struggle with that point. Everybody struggles with it, but it's like, you know it's coming. So then that can tee off more anxiety. Like, oh, God, it's coming. I cannot escape it. So I found this mental mechanism years ago, and it's worked for me to where it's this faceless dark entity that's coming towards me. And instead of me backstepping, because it's going to be inevitable, it's going to close this distance on me and we're going to meet up, I just think of, hey, you old son of a bitch, come here, and step into it and hug it before. So I set the tone for it. I decide to go to it. So mentally, I'm deciding to go and embrace it on my own accord.
Do you remember the first time you found that visualization?
It was just doing breath hold exercises, just laying down in the house, controlled setting. That's why you want to go to these places and tinker in controlled settings.
Right.
It's not, you're not in the you don't want to be having to figure it out when it's potentially your life on the line. So I played with that, doing the CO2 and O2 breathing tables, which is like, conversely. So one of the breathing tables, you can pick your different levels of it. So one, you're going to say a higher level probably would be, I breathe for 15 seconds. I hold my breath for a minute. I breathe for 15 seconds, minute 15, breathe for 15 seconds, minute 30. And you stack it that way. Or you have a long, like a 2 minute recovery, and your recovery's just come down, but it's like a 2 minute breath hold the same time, mm-hmm. over and over.
Mm-hmm. And then as the diaphragm continues to spasm and then relaxes and then spasm, is the entity continuing to get closer to you? And are you just continuing to move into that discomfort?
No, I'm hugging it.
You're hugging
I'm in it. And the amazing thing is you get past that.
Mm.
You blow past that point and you get calm again. You don't have that feeling anymore. It's hard to get past that.
Right.
It's a term in the freediving world is the breath hold doesn't start until your first contraction. Because anybody can hold their breath.
That's what I tell my girlfriend when she has her kid.
Suck it up, honey.
That's what Healy told me. Here, putting Healy on the phone. We're going to breathe through this. You know, if pro surfing doesn't work out, you could become a Lamaze instructor. That could be your next.
It was actually really interesting, though, when we did go and do our different breathing classes and stuff with the midwives and doulas, or I don't even remember now. It's amazing how you forget a lot of the stuff. We were so in it, but now my daughter's 4 and a half, but there were like amazing things that were right in line from all the things that learned from breath holding.
Right.
It's basically all the same concepts.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so transferable. I was reading Breath by James Nestor. Mm-hmm. It was an awesome book. And, in it, there's a section where he talks about this phenomenon called email apnea, where so many people open Gmail and they get this ping of anxiety to the point where they won't breathe for like a minute. And then they'll like the small hits of anxiety that I think you're talking about, which like transfer to our brains feeling kind of overwhelmed by information and social media, it has an effect on our breathing patterns.
Yes.
And it's so interesting to notice how your breathing patterns change in the face of technology.
You know what's interesting regarding that James Nestor book, Breathe, is, you know, I've been doing breath stuff since I was basically a child, but I always thought I was not capable of nasal breathing. Because my nose just, it's never clear and it's always full of salt water, mm-hmm. you know, just from getting so much water blasted up there and it doesn't come out very easily. So I was always a mouth breather and I thought it was impossible from like the nose breaks and all of that. And I was reading that book on, it was a long flight I remember. So maybe I was going to Indonesia or something from LA. And I was like, okay, I'm going to force myself to nasal breathe on this flight. I had probably never done nasal breathing for more than 5 minutes in my entire life.
Whoa.
At that point. And I forced myself to, and it was so difficult. Like I felt like I was like blacking out. Like I couldn't get enough. Like it felt like a tiny straw that I was breathing through the whole time. And I just ground through it for about 3 hours. I fell asleep and I woke up still breathing through my nose in my sleep. And I've been nasal breathing ever since. All it took was me to be on that plane and force myself, and it totally reset my ability to do that. I thought it was impossible for me.
That's remarkable.
And nowadays, I fall asleep, I wake up, I'm still nasal breathing, I can do hard cardio, not open my mouth.
Really? Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. Do you remember the part in the book where he talks about Phalum gum? It's in the very end, so I think it's a Swiss brand of gum that you chew it and it feels like you're chewing a leather sole of a boot.
I remember something
and
about this.
Dude, I got a pack of this shit and it's my girlfriend gets so annoyed because it's
just like... Is it actually like the...
It looks like gum, but it's just like 10 times as hard and tough.
Is it like pine tree like sap or something?
Something, yeah. Or like, you know, Bigfoot's dick. Something really hard and leathery. And what he says in the book is that you're... your maxilla, I think it's called your maxilla. It's a membrane in the front of your face that is bone, but it can change and restructure over time. And mm-hmm. just by chewing this gum, it releases stem cells into your face that can help widen your face and your nasal passage. So I'm all about this shit, dude. I chew on the phallum gum when I'm working out. I'm the phallus gum, dude. Going to bed with it, sleeping. Yeah, I think that's really cool. So when you are prepping for a big wave session, are you also doing a breath hold?
Yeah, usually I'll try to at least get one out.
Yeah,
you know, even if it's just, you know, sit there in the boat or on the ski or whatever and just hold my breath for like a minute 45 or something just to click over.
When was the last time you felt really scared surfing?
The last time I felt really scared surfing was that giant Maverick swell. What was it, 2 years ago? The humongous one.
The humongous one, yep.
Yeah, I remember everyone was towing.
Yep.
I was sitting, I was feeling... like,
well, a lot of guys were paddling too, but barely anyone caught a wave because it was so massive. Yeah,
but I was that was during all the COVID bullshit, so I hadn't been traveling a lot and hadn't been surfing a lot of big waves. So I was kind of like on a dry streak and went straight into that, and it was just like, oh my god! And I was so far, I was all the way out the back where like Pete was towing into those, and I'm just thinking like, I mean, I could chip shot into something like humongous out here, but if I get caught inside, I'm basically like in line with the left at the bowl of Mavericks. I'm gonna take like a couple of 70 footers on the head before I even hit the bowl, which is gonna be hell on earth. Like, it's not gonna be a pretty scene for me if I get caught inside out here right now. And I felt like I was super out of place and shouldn't be there.
What size board?
I didn't catch a wave that day.
Most people didn't. I think Twiggy Hail Married into two and got fucking destroyed.
Yeah. And that he was like 200 yards further in than me.
And still outside the regular bowl.
Yes.
Yeah, man.
Like, I couldn't even see those guys from where I was out at.
Yeah. That was fucking... that was a crazy day too. I've never seen Mavericks like that. I remember going out in a boat that day, and I was there. My brother, who's a filmmaker, he had never been out to Mavericks, and I was like, sick, I want to go like surf Mavs in front of my brother. Like, he's my big brother. And I remember going out and worrying that the channel was going to close out. I was like on
that. Oh, yeah.
And I remember,
I'm sure it did.
Yeah. And I was like, and I was on a fucking ski, like, before going out, Sean Dollar was doing rescue, and I sat on the back of the ski with Dollar, thinking that we were kind of just cruising, and Willem Banks caught a wave and got fucking destroyed, and Dollar just goes, yeah, like, in the fucking bowl. We pick up.
Oh, no, we're in.
And I'm like, oh, no, like, should I jump off right now? What's happening? We fucking pick up Willem, and I just looked so chaotic and out of control, and so few people were catching waves, and it was just frankly too big for me, and I didn't surf that day.
Well, and the playing field, like I was saying, was so big that something could easily happen to you that day and no one would have seen until it's too late.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, I haven't seen so-and-so in a while. Oh, uh-oh.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, it's funny that you mentioned that session, because it was kind of, it's one of the only times I ever went out to Mavericks and didn't surf because I felt like it was too big for me. Mm-hmm. And it felt like I was very, I remember going home that day being like, good job, Kyle. Good job.
Getting wiser.
Yeah. So you didn't catch a wave that day.
I didn't catch a wave. I should have just sat in where everyone else was and tried to catch a couple in there. Manny caught a couple of great waves, actually.
Yep.
But yeah, I was out the back, kind of all or nothing, and it ended up with nothing.
Yeah.
But not dead.
Which is something.
Yep.
Speaking of almost dying, we have a question from John Rose, which is, tell us about bull riding.
Oh, I'm not good at it.
You're not good at it.
Yeah, I know that. That's been established a couple of times. Yeah, I went to, I was with some of the boys 1 year, and I basically set a goal for myself. I really wanted to jump on a bull at one of those Mexican rodeos. So kind of my mechanism of making sure it happened is I told, you know, my friends on the trip. So it was like Fuller, Reef McIntosh, and Rosie. And so, of course, they're more than happy to facilitate that. So we went to the rodeo in Tecklamon. We found out when it was, and it was like, it's a proper rodeo there.
Been there.
Like, it's a big arena. There's probably a couple thousand people in the stands.
Well, 14-year-old, you know, Mexican kids, like, dressed to the nines with their girlfriends.
Oh, yeah. And so we're there, and we're, I mean, it is not a tourist destination.
No.
We're getting, like, vibed out. There's, like, a couple of guys that were surfers that were there from Texas, I believe. But we were the only gringos in the place out of, you know, a couple thousand people. And, yeah, full mariachi band, announcer, the whole deal. And there was, you know, in between getting, like, shoulder checked, there's one Mexican cowboy, old-timer. You could tell he's respected. All the young guys made a point of going out of their way to shake his hand and stuff. And he was actually really nice to us. We were sitting right by him. So Danny Fuller goes and he's like, hey, my friend, he wants to jump on a bull. The guy looks back at me and he's like, oh, all right. Yells for a guy to come over, relays a message. And next thing you know, I'm going to jump on a bull. And the first bull that we went on was, it was like this young steer. It was like, it was pretty lame. And then so it did it again with a larger bull. And I'm in the chute. And you're facing the guy in the opposite chute, and it was like a local cowboy from there, a young guy. And they opened the chute.
So the chute is the little kind of just big enough for the bull to fit in.
Yeah.
And they put you on top of it.
Mm-hmm. And so he's going to go first. He goes first. The bull takes a hard left, which pendulums his body out to the right. And then the bull goes to the left again, which makes him swing around and his face hits the bars and his head explodes basically. And he's unconscious, but he hits another bar with his face before, like, as he's falling off. Dude, I'm like, I just watched this guy die. I've seen people in really bad shape before and I'm like, that guy is not ever going to be the same or he's dead. I'm pretty sure he's dead. And so I'm like, oh, my God, what's going on? The guys pull him off. His face is just unrecognizable. And there's me, the asshole, supposedly going up next.
How sober were you?
Probably too sober. And
you're like, wait, I was wasted. I was sober after that.
Yeah. I just had board shorts on. I had no shoes because I showed up with slippers. This little kid held my shoes. And so I'm standing up on the gates, and these guys are like over me at this point because it's like, I didn't mean to do this, but how bad does that look? Like this disrespectful looking gringo and their friend probably just died right there. And so I have this bull's thrashing. They're pissing it off as much as possible. And I'm like, I can't put my legs around this thing. I'm going to get my legs broken because it's smashing into the cage so hard. So I was just going to plop down on it real fast, right when I hear Trace, right? So I have 1 foot on the bars of the gate that's going to swing open and on the other bars that are fixed on the other side. And they go, uno, and then just open the gate. So my foot's still on it, on the bars. So I'm like doing the splits, and this bull just yanks me by my arm out of the gates. So I'm on a trajectory for doom at this point. Like my butt, by the time my butt lands on it, he's already bucking up. So that puts my feet in the air. And I remember seeing the lights in my feet in the air and flying straight up. So my feet are over my head. As I was coming down, the bull is bucking back up and his tailbone hit me like in the back of the head, which basically like knocked me out. And then I was landing on the ground in the same way that I just was. So like back of the head and shoulders, I skinned both of my knees from my knees hitting the ground, landing on my neck. And, I can't see anything. Like my bell is rung. And, I feel some guys clawing at me, and this crowd beforehand was just jeering crowd, like wanted to see me die. And I was just thinking, like, I don't care if this bull comes back and murders me right now, I will not give them the satisfaction of getting dragged out of here. So I'm like fighting off these guys that are trying to help me. And then I was breathing and I could see like a little pinhole, and then the image got bigger and bigger. And as soon as it got big enough, I just ran and dove through the bars and got the hell out of there. I was like, oh man, I'm messed up. I was like, I'm going to be feeling this tomorrow. But strangely enough, we ended up leaving and I felt fine the next morning, surfed again. So fast forward this, many years later, probably like 7 or 8 years later, I'm at Desert Point in Lombok, Indonesia. And this guy comes up to me. He's like, I almost got fucking killed because of you. I'm like, oh, excuse me? Tell me more. And he's like, he was one of the Texas guys that was there that night. He's like, when you guys split, then we stayed a little longer. And the friends of the guy, he's like, that guy died. So the friends of him were just drunk and mad. And so they got chased and they tried to like stab those guys. And there's do you remember the big wall that's around that arena? There?
Yeah.
It's like a 10-foot wall. It's like a big wall. They had to jump over that. They're like, we barely got over it. We would have got killed. Because they thought I was you because I was blonde too.
Oh my fucking God.
So that's the only way I know that that guy actually did die. Because I looked at him and I was like, that looks like what happens when a person dies.
Whoa. I remember being at Grom and seeing, I want to say it was like a DVS ad of you. It was some
Quicksilver
ad.
That's when we rode the bulls in Puerto Escondido.
That's an amazing story.
That was a different time.
That was the second time.
Fuller jumped on one that time too.
And how did he do?
About the same as me.
Oh Jesus. That's so fucking scary. Oh God, I have goosebumps.
It was just poor decision making.
Do you feel like you're kind to yourself? Do you feel like you have a good inner monologue, like a confident good inner monologue, or do you have self-loathing and that's the engine that drives you?
I don't know if it would be, I mean, it's a little of everything, but primarily I expect a lot out of myself, and I don't like to allow myself excuses. I feel like you have to take responsibility for most things that happen in your life and to you. If you're not looking at some way that you played a role in the different outcomes, whether it's even how you deal with the fallout mentally or you know, what's the chain of events that got me to a positive or negative outcome. Like I'm always looking at that. What could I have done differently? What will I do differently next time?
Right. I've heard you in other interviews talk about how your family grew up with not a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume that that could either drive someone into a victim mindset or a very self-reliant mindset. Do you feel like that influenced your kind of radical ownership perception at all?
For sure. 100%. Because I was like, okay, if I want to change anything, nobody's coming to help me out. You know, like obviously my parents were great parents. I'm not saying they were deadbeats or anything. They always were super supportive. Right. I'm very fortunate to have them.
But you weren't spoiled.
No, I had to earn it. Like I had to go hustle. I had to make my own money. Stuff like that, which I'm so thankful for. But if you're sitting around and waiting for a handout, you're going to be waiting a long time. And it's also, I found, you know, it's very, very true. It's like if you're sitting on the side of the highway, sitting in your car on your phone, you know, you're broken down, see how long it is before somebody comes and helps you. Then open the door of that car and start trying to push it on your own and see how fast people come and help you. People are willing. Usually people that are in a position to be able to help you don't have a lot of time and bandwidth. And they've gotten to that position by learning certain things in life about like ownership and responsibility and putting in effort and, you know, having good intentions around the things you go after. So if they're not going to bet on a bunch of losers. They just don't have time for that. But if they see that you're open to work, to maybe have to, there's parts or aspects of this pursuit that you're going to have to work four times harder for to get the same result as the guy next to you. But it's a crucial part of this puzzle. If you're willing to do things like that, then people are like, okay, I'm not wasting my time to give a hand up to this person, to give them an opportunity. So things really come together.
When did you first, I think that's a really powerful insight to hold. And I think it's true. I do agree that like successful people or people who are willing to help you probably saw some aspect of themselves in you.
Yes.
Because they knew that it was hard and that they had to grind. And if they see that quality in you, they're willing to help come push the car. Did you learn that? Do you remember when you learned that, or if there was a situation that helped you kind of embody that philosophy?
I think it's primarily in retrospect that I understand why different people were helpful to me now, because now I'm in that position.
Right.
I help a lot of people with advice and pairing different people and
connections.
Yeah. Right. I do a lot of that kind of stuff, and I'm very selective and deliberate about it because I know it's like you do it with the wrong people and you open a huge can of worms.
Yeah.
You try to do something good and it ends up just blowing up in your face and you're stuck in the middle of some bullshit. So you really have to have like a high confidence that the people you're helping aren't going to waste your time or make your life harder.
Right.
You know, when you got a lot of things going on.
Or make you look bad, because if you recommend someone who blows it, then it tarnishes your reputation.
Absolutely. And I take that very seriously. Like if somebody does that, they're going to hear about it from me. I'm like, hey, I'm making this connection, but I'm not doing it as a favor. I would never do this for you, even if I liked you, if you weren't good at this, if you didn't put effort into it. There's no like freebie handouts just because we're buddies. Understand that's the expectation going forward in this.
Right. Growing up on the North Shore, I feel like it's common to have a mentality of that the sponsors are going to come chasing you and you can kind of just cruise because the whole surf world is here and there is a lot of media at your doorstep at certain times in your life. And it does seem like a common story that kids will get good at surfing, get sponsors, not really learn that mentality, and then be high and dry by the time they're in their late 20s. And it seems like you have kind of taken that different mentality. Like, what were things that you did early on in your surfing career that were different than the people you saw around you?
It's learning the business, how the business works. I became really interested in that after I got dropped by my first big sponsor after having like my best year ever, and just realizing like, no matter how hard you work, there's things that are outside of your control that can just blindside you. Like, it's almost like being a farmer. Like, you have a flood one year and you're just fucked. You could have been doing everything right. So I'm like, okay, I need to understand this playing field. I need to be able to position myself in a way that, you know, I either see those things coming and I'm prepared for them, or just know how to navigate it. And the other aspect of the professional surfing career is my mantra, I guess, would be make yourself irreplaceable. Because even during hard times when there's cutbacks and everything, you know, a brand can only cut off their nose to spite their face so much. If you make yourself irreplaceable, you can weather a lot of storms. So what does that look like? It might look different for different people depending on their skill sets. I've always been really interested in design and business and marketing. So I always pitched in from when I was in my teens in areas of the companies like that. And that was my route, you know, and my niche. And especially these days, like, good luck having a surf career just being a good surfer. That just doesn't happen anymore. But I think there's some, you know, it's a hard pill for some people to swallow. It's called the, you know, I don't like to see that. I like to see people be able to you know, chase their dreams and, and push the level of surfing, push our sport and be supported doing that. I by no means want, you know, to see the cheer for the destruction. But there's new and interesting ways that the people left over that are currently successful in the surfing world are like force multipliers for companies, where it's very collaborative. And instead of just like, oh yeah, you know, patronizing, because that's how it be sometimes, like kind of patronizing stuff where they kind of...
How do you mean patronizing?
So before, there's always, even if it was like a low-level derelict team manager or something, right? When you would come with ideas as a surfer to the brand, they'd be like, they kind of hear you out, but they're like, oh yeah, that's cute, but you know, you're a dumb surfer. It was really hard to get like ideas across the table. And I liked, you know, contributing. So, you know, there's always kind of like this unspoken mentality with a lot of different companies where they're just like, oh, that's cute.
But you're in a box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're automatically
just
like,
get us some photos.
You're a surfer. Yeah. You're not that smart. But nowadays that's changed because only people who are left over are people who are basically self-starters. They have their own platforms and everything. And look, I'm on the other end of this in some ways with like Protect, which is a company I'm a co-founder of. So
now you really see it from the inside.
Yeah, I'm part of that inside and I'm making decisions about like we just signed Nathan Florence. We brought him as a partner and actually a co-owner of the company and Kimmy Werner. So being able to go to people that I think really are in line with our company's ethos, who are trusted people by their audiences because they've earned that trust, you know? It's not a fiat trust like a lot of like influencer types are. And it's very collaborative.
Right.
Like you're a part of this. Bring your ideas. Let's do this together.
Right. What do you think Kimmy has done smart in her career?
Well, I think what Kimmy has done smart in her career is she's stayed true to herself. I'm sure it's not been without because she's got such a diverse audience.
Yeah.
Like you think her going out and like hunting with a bow and arrow and showing that she doesn't get heat or kickback from a lot of, or like a good segment of the people who are probably following her. But she's been honest and she has that credibility because she really does these things and she has a great way of explaining the whys.
She really does. She's a phenomenal storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. But, you know, people, as much as I hate to say it, as much as I feel like the general intelligence seems to be degrading, people still have an instinct, whether it's front of mind or not, for bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, and if people see inconsistencies in a person, you know, there's something back there that makes them, oh yeah, I'll put a pin in that.
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to what we were saying about language versus body language. Humans are so much better at reading each other through body language and even tone and cadence than we assume. Like, it's pretty easy to spot liars.
Yeah.
Like, some people maybe are really good at it and just sociopathic, but often you can kind of tell who's bullshitting, even with like an ad, you know, like people talk about the Instagram ads and like, be authentic. It's like, you can't pretend to be authentic. Like it really does show because humans have millions of years of learning whether or not you should be able to trust this guy talking about their fucking ionized water setup that they have on Instagram.
Totally. And I guess that's what I was trying to explain. It's like, whereas like people who if you're like introspective and you kind of like to break down, you know, the whys, you'll be like, that's a liar because of A, B, and C that I'm noticing right now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think there's a good segment of the population that don't even know. They're just like, I just get a feeling.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Like it's still in there with everybody.
Right. Absolutely, man. I mean,
But the sick, weird thing that I'm watching is the people that support people that they know are lying to them. Like those super weird influencer stuff, like the Kardashian shit and stuff. Like what part of the human psychology knows that you're being shilled stuff by people who aren't honest and are like as plastic as they come, and you're still into it?
It might be that there's a segment of the audience that values, on a very deep level, values entertainment over truth. And yes, they just don't care anymore. And it's just, if you can entertain me, even if I know it's a lie, I'm down. And I think that sound melodramatic, but I think our civilization will, the success and failure of it will probably be predicated upon if we can, as a species, value truth over entertainment and be willing to sit with ourselves a little bit, you know, and take those breath holds, as you talk about, and have those moments of pause and reflection, so we're not just being led around by our dopamine circuits all the time without any clarity of the path that we really want to take in life.
Yeah, I guess that's where, like, my so-called conspiracy side is going to kick in, is like, with so many potential outlets to hide from that and keep you satiated with pointless entertainment, or at least confused. Like, I don't think all of that is just because people are feeding what seems to be this disgusting primal urge to just constantly satiate yourself. I think there's a certain part of it that is intentional. I think there is a certain part of that that is designed to keep people weak, designed to keep people stupid and governed, you know?
Yeah, create the perfect consumer.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a bit more about, you mentioned people who can help you greatly in life. And I've come across a few of those people myself, and often I find they're not ones who are in your circle that you kind of grew up with and like just, you know,
no.
They're usually people that come from they're like a shooting star that just like somehow comes into your orbit, but they're from a completely different world, a completely different industry. And if they like you, they can change your life.
Mm-hmm.
And or be willing to make a connection that can change your life. And I've had a few of these people, in my life who really have helped me and really have either made connections or told me things that changed the way I think about my life. And I think that there's a real art to interacting with those people, because often they are kind of inundated with people who want them to help.
Yeah.
And it just, they need to create some kind of a wall around them. How have you found, or have you found any rules of thumb for communicating with important people to not come across as obsequious or or get shut out, but actually turn it into like a productive collaboration where they get something out of it as well?
Yeah, I think for me, it's we're talking about how you grew up poor and you spend so much of the front half of your life, if you're like a motivated person that wants to make things happen, like just, I'm not looking for any handouts, just looking for opportunity. Like, I just want the opportunity to fail. Like, I just want the opportunity to do something bigger or better. I want the opportunity to make these ideas into reality. Just so you have this kind of like, oh my God, this is a successful person. They can help me do it. And you feel like, oh, I can't be myself or something. Or like, I gotta like.
It's like texting a pretty girl or something. Yeah, it's like, taking 15 minutes to craft the
clearly,
text.
I clearly cannot be good enough.
Yeah.
A while ago, I'm like, I got to the point in life, which is a great place. It's like, I'm just totally honest. And I'm a very curious person. And I really, really value people's insights to things that I don't have experience in. I think it's worth its weight in gold, if not more. So I'm just very curious, and I guess, I don't know if you would call it confidence, but I'm just like this is how I am. Take it or leave it. I'm not trying to hide anything from anybody. And things just, people trust you then. Especially people who are surrounded by yes men and bullshitters and people who, with ulterior motives all the time.
Right.
And they sniff that out pretty fast. So I just don't really, you know, have like a big ulterior motive. I'm just thankful to have conversations with super insightful people. And yeah, if we can collaborate on something later, usually I can help fix some problems for them in areas that they don't understand. And yeah, it's kind of how it usually starts.
Right. Yeah, because I mean, if those people aren't in the surfing world or spearfishing world, it's also a once in a lifetime opportunity. I often say, like, I think I've batted way above my weight in this podcast with some of the guests I've been able to get on. And often in that first email, I will say, I'll give you a surf lesson.
Yeah.
And
smart.
They're stoked. They're like, what? I have no, like, they've never, because you kind of need a little bit of that help when entering the ocean. And it's, I think it's such a mesmerizing thing for so many people. But like, how are you going to learn how to surf unless you have someone to teach you?
Totally.
And it freaking works just having a little bit of that novelty. They're like, hell yeah, let's do this.
Yeah. And I mean, what I've found, there's a couple of things that I've found where I've landed in as far as my roles. And it wasn't necessarily what I thought it was going to be when I was younger, but just seeing like where my strengths really ended up lying. I find myself constantly being a connector of two worlds. I kind of have feet in two different worlds. So if somebody needs to understand something that's more related to the ocean or outdoor stuff, or even navigating some politics here and there, or the safety aspect of things or vetting things. But I still understand the world they're coming from enough to where they're like, okay, he understands these concepts and can give me answers. Like he's in both places. And that's similar to all the brands that I work with. They're coming from different worlds, but they admire surfing, the surf lifestyle, the ocean lifestyle. Or they might come from hunting. They might come from fishing primarily. I can understand that side and give them great advice on how to navigate coming in a respectful way and not trying to buy your way into a different category and start the process of creating legitimacy. But none of that can happen unless you bring something to the table. And that's what I always tell them, like, hey, if you show up to a barbecue, show up with a case of beer. So like, if you're going to show up and like, you're not going to rebrand your fucking Volley shorts and say they're surf trunks now. And now we're in surf. Like, fuck no, that's stupid. I will not be a part of that.
Yeah. It's like, it's like
something better.
The surf world, it's like white blood cells that like sense something foreign, sense a foreign object when like K2 tries to come into the picture.
But that's
something.
How it used to be. It's changed. That's been an amazing change that I saw. Remember how attacked like K2 and Nike and stuff got. But since all the big surf brands got bought up and, you know, you can find it in Target, Costco, and stuff like that, it's, people are way more open. I think people are more like gear oriented now. It's like you saw Patagonia with the Malloys really make the change and transition successfully well ahead of their time. Now people are looking at outdoor gear in surfing in the surf world. Like, when's the last time you saw somebody with a giant Billabong logo and a Billabong trunks or Quicksilver, or insert the name?
Yeah.
Because back when we were Groms, you were like brand loyal to stuff.
Totally.
You know, you had your flavor of surf brand and everything. That doesn't exist anymore. You might have like, you know, a pair of Patagonia pants and like a, you know, a Ruka shirt or something like that.
Yeah. I think there's also something about the, like, I think that surfing is publicly a very left sport, but privately a very right sport.
I think so.
And I think a lot of people...
Brands. That's the tail wagging the dog.
Right.
So this is the beautiful thing that I'm seeing in the breakdown and kind of chaos period of the surf industry right now. I think I got a secondhand quote of Herbie Fletcher a long time ago in an action sports retailer trade show, telling somebody like, see all this brands, see all this. None of this is surfing. This is clothes and products. So like, if you think about it, why would surf companies that sell a product dictate what surfing is to the world? It doesn't make sense.
Right.
So it should be from the act of it. It should be the participants. I mean, like fashion and everything, that's cool. And like setting the tone, the industry is always going to be a part of it. But I feel like the industry kind of had 99% of the voice in how surfing is portrayed in the world.
Yeah.
I think that's going to change now in this chaos.
Yeah. And I think that you came into hunting in the right time because there are, I think, a lot of surfers who, yeah, are maybe they're further right or just more centrist, and hunting is
centrist.
I think centrist is probably the better way to put it. But just
like things are so far left that you can, like, you could be a classic liberal. You're alt right now.
I'm centrist now, and I feel like I used to be left.
Well, freedom of speech.
Yeah, when
Nazi?
I was watching wait, John what? Stewart exactly. Yeah. You said something about curiosity. You're like, I've always been a very curious person, and which means you're into learning, which means you have ways to go about learning. And I think that I'm wondering, how do you go about learning stuff, and what's something that you have had to learn maybe recently that you can think of that you had to develop maybe some kind of system, or like you have literacy with your own mind to the point that you know you need to do breath holds before you get into an intense situation. You know what's good for you, what's bad for you. So I would assume that when you try and go about learning something new, you have some sort of system or time of day or place or sequencing that you use to learn it.
So I guess my compartmentalized learning is kind of the way I like to do things, in that it's like I'm looking at like the different, really break down all the minute skills and the new general thing I'm trying to learn, and look at it like a Tetris game. So each line that you get all the way across and it disappears, you get more points. That's one of the skills that's involved. Sometimes it takes you a long time to just get one of those lines through, and sometimes you drop, that piece and you get four lines at once.
Mm.
But you can't expect it to always be at the same pace. There's going to be certain steps. Like I said, some things you're going to have to work way harder than the guy next to you, and it's just a small step. And that really frustrates people, and they tend to give up or skip past that. So I just try to really break it down and like, okay, I'm just going to focus on this next step of the process, and I'm not going to move on until I feel like I've gotten that. Because I think how I've created bad habits in things that I've learned in the past is by kind of just looking at it as some big smoothie and playing whack-a-mole with the different skill sets that you need to acquire.
Yeah, it's like trying to learn how to do an air reverse before you can do a bottom turn.
Exactly. So I found that to be effective.
Which I've successfully done.
Yeah. Like, and it's so hard to break bad habits.
It's so hard.
So when I'm like, even if it sucks and it's more boring and it's more tedious, I've done enough things and learned enough different skills in my life to know I don't want to have to deal with bad habits. Because I have ones that I have to this day that just annoy the shit out of me. Yeah. And no matter what I do, like, I keep defaulting to these bad habits.
It's like having a bunch of shit in your house that you now have to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I know all about that.
I got to put these on Craigslist now. Like, God, I never wanted to. Yes. It was just that night I got drunk and went on Amazon.
Yeah, exactly. I know that super well.
So what's a skill you've tried to learn, and a ways that you have delineated it into a step-by-step process? Is there anything that you can think of?
I mean, archery is always one.
Okay. So what is, because you're archery hunting with people that are maybe way better than you, more experienced than you. How do you not slip into the thought loop of, fuck, I'm not as good as this guy, and having that just consume your time and space and make it impossible to learn a new step-by-step process?
Oh, I don't think that at all. I'm like, if I'm with somebody who's a really good archer and hunter, I'm just trying to eat up everything that I can that I see that they're doing different and ask them why they're doing certain things.
Okay, so give me an example of a trip that you were on and something you were trying to learn.
Oh, geez, when I hunt with some of my friends, you know, here in Hawaii that are multi-generational hunters, archers over here, their amount of knowledge and just the animal knowledge and behavioral knowledge, the different small parts of the animal's behavior that can be exploited, opens up opportunities that I would never ever have. So just even watching when to apply pressure, when to be bold and fast, and when to be extremely disciplined and be able to give up and scoot out of a situation and just leave it be, because you're just going to disturb the area so much. Knowing when to toggle those little, it's like watching a DJ with all his sound mixing board and stuff, knowing when and where to do those things.
Do you feel like it's been an advantage for you hunting axis deer in Hawaii? Because so much action. Like explain a bit more about that for people who have not hunted axis deer.
So axis deer are incredibly difficult to hunt. They're just always wired. So couple that with there's no seasons, at least on private land here in Hawaii, and most of it's private land. Because axis deer is considered an invasive species, they, you know, the populations, unless we get droughts, because they're actually such healthy animals, they don't get sick. But when we have droughts, that's only real die-offs. Hunters can't even keep the equilibrium, you know, just to keep it at a steady number. They breed so much. So there's a lot of them. So you got the hardest animals to hunt, probably the hardest animals I've ever had to hunt. But you have a lot of them. So you have multiple opportunities. And there's no season. You can take as many as you want because they are considered an invasive species. So the amount of repetitions you can get, if you're a bow hunter in Hawaii and you have access, that's the main thing, is like having access to like these different areas where there's a ton of deer. So you got to have friends. but there is public stuff as well. But I would say the amount of reps that you get in hunting axis deer in Hawaii, you'll get more experience in, say, collectively you hunt for 2 weeks in a year. You'll get more experience in those 2 weeks than you probably will in 3 years in the continental U.S. because it's just a different situation. You know, you have these smaller windows. You got to draw tags on public land.
You have smaller windows across the continental U.S.
Yes.
Yeah.
So. And you're very limited. You know, they're species that are native to the continent. So they're like, okay, we got to manage this. All the management is done through biologists for the most part until the blue hair people get involved and start doing dumb shit that isn't science based. So it's like, okay, you can go hunting over here and you're like, oh my God, I need to bring like 2 dozen arrows. If I go on an elk hunt, I'm like, I'm bringing 5 arrows and I'm only going to need one. So you can spend your whole year preparing for the elk season to open in September, hunt your ass off. I think the success rate on average for public land is a hunter kills one bull elk for every 10 years he hunts. So that's one arrow. But the average is one arrow in 10 years.
Yep.
That's going to kill a bull elk for you.
It's remarkable to me. I was just in Montana on a hunt, and it's remarkable to me that you can create such a robust hunting culture with such a limited season. Mm-hmm. It's like, imagine if you could only surf on the North Shore for like 2 months, maybe. But still people just dedicate their lives to it. And there's so much lead up for this one moment. You can forge an entire culture of obsessive humans around this pursuit.
I think that just goes to show how innate it is to us as humans. We've been hunting for our entire existence. Mm-hmm. It's an outlet. We need to be in nature. We like spending time in nature with, you know, a chosen company. Yeah, it is. It is pretty amazing when you think about it. But the good thing is, say if it's an elk, that's 200 pounds of meat. That's usually the yield that you get off a elk, 200 plus pounds. So that's going to last you a solid year.
Has there been anything surprising to you learning how to hunt elk?
Yeah, it is a lot of surprising things. It's very different from hunting axis deer. You can get away with way more with the elk because they're big animals and they're noisy. So they're used to hearing like branches crack and stuff like that. So for the most part, you can move a lot more freely. You can move faster. But you really have to put yourself in the situation where they're making mistakes. Like obviously primetime rut, the bulls are, they're fighting. They're just trying to stick any cow that's in heat.
Yeah.
You know, they're making some poor decisions, which is definitely like, I've learned a lot about life and ourselves through watching the decision making that so leads to their,
hey, that's me late night at a bar. So back in my 20s.
Just like, there's probably arrows flying over my back, metaphorical arrows that I didn't even know.
Let's go.
Exactly. Oh my God.
How's your calling?
My calling sucks. I just cow call.
Mm.
I don't bugle. I'd like to learn more, and get better at it. But I'm usually hunting with a buddy who calls a lot better than me.
Mm-hmm.
But I also half of the bulls I've killed have just been, I've just stalked them same way I would do deer, except I do some crawling and stuff on some of the ones I've gotten. But I feel fine doing it that way too. Is once you locate them,
yeah,
because that's kind of like that's what I'm used to from Hawaii.
It's so fucking sick.
It is sick.
It's so sick.
But the thing that I was told, which was a mistake I was making in the beginning, in Hawaii, I would say, 7 out of 10 shots you're probably going to take is going to be from a seated position or on your knees because you're in some cover, you've been hiding, you crawled up to the spot. And good advice that I got was like, don't be on your knees when you're shooting elk.
Hmm.
Just because they're so tall. They like that angle is going to be weird if they do come in close to you, and you want to be able to move if they come in from a different direction, and just making sure that you're not like behind a bush, because that's, you're usually crawling up to a bush then getting to your knees and like peeking around the corner. You want to be in front of the bush or in front of the tree because they can't pick out your outline if you have something behind you. And then if they come in at an unexpected angle, you can have that ability to adjust without something in front of you. Because that's the thing, especially the bull elk when they're in rut, they're like, they're coming, you hear them, or you hear them crashing through all angry, coming to fight or come into the cow call. And, but they'll do weird things. They'll stall up, and you probably already went to full draw anticipating them coming out in one spot, and they'll just stop, stall up and do like a half loop around and come in from a different angle. And then if they see you, like you can't move towards them, so you end up there at full draw with some bull elk trying to figure out what you are at like 30 yards away from you.
Are you often working in teams where you'll have someone behind you calling them in?
Yeah, usually you have there's a guy. Half of the time I've had bulls coming into a call and the caller's behind you because ungulates like that, they really have a great way of knowing where a sound came from and remembering the exact spot. So when that bull comes in, he's going to be looking to where he knows that call came from. So you want him looking past you. You don't want the call coming right to you.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, I've become really fallen in love with hunting after you. So I'm even newer to it. Growing up as a beach kid, just learning how to navigate the mountains has been such a fun, new, and novel experience for me. And also learning more about the North American conservation model has been, for me, as you know, I would consider myself an environmentalist, the most successful environmental story I've ever come across.
Yeah, it's like, amazing. We're so fortunate to have that.
It's a really remarkable thing. I mean, if you think about that we almost hunted bison to extinction mm-hmm. around the year 1900, and now they're back in full force, and through this model and through these funding mechanisms that we've been able to sustain these species for, you know, in the Sand County Almanac, he says for a man, be it of a man of means or not, you know, like it's, mm-hmm. it's so damn cool that even if you didn't grow up rich, you can still be a hunter and still get 200 pounds of meat for yourself for a $20 tag. And if you're a Montana resident or something like that.
It's absolutely amazing. And I think something that really speaks to it is, like, obviously the hook and bullet crowd, that's kind of the term for, you know, the outdoor mm-hmm. world, are going to be the last motherfuckers on the planet that are going to be excited about an extra tax. Obviously.
Yeah.
That is not the demographic.
Dude, I trip out on this.
They're like, no problem. Like, across the board, if you're asked, like, no problem. We are happy to pay extra tax on these things if it's going to this conservation.
Right. Yeah, the Pittman-Robertson Act and the I think, and then also the Dingell-Johnson Act in
Dingell-Johnson.
The Dingell, and I think nice. It's an 11% excise tax on all ammunition and all hunting related gear goes directly to conservation. Mm-hmm. Most people don't think about that if they're picking up, you know, some bullets.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really cool, and it's something I still feel so new to, and it's just an amazing, it's an amazing story to learn about. And it makes me, this is cliche to say, but it makes me proud to be an American.
Yeah. It really is one of the things to be proud to be American of right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's always had to be defended.
Yeah.
It's constantly under attack. Like, it's not something that's just going to continue to exist without people engaging in maintaining it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only hunters. Like, everybody gets to, you can just be like, I'm going to disappear into the wilderness, into public land for 6 months if I want to. You can go and disappear. There's so much public land. Like, people have these fantasies of, like, doing it, like, you literally can do
just
it.
Just go.
Yeah. There's not other places in the world you can really do this.
Yeah,
and know that you're on the right side of the law, and or you're safe-ish. Mm-hmm. Besides, you know, dealing with nature,
bears.
Yeah, but that's a funny thing too. Is like when you get these debates about outdoor stuff, and it's like I was thinking about it one time. I'm like, man, how rare is it for me to be on a trail? Like, when I'm hunting, if you're like, oh my gosh, there's a trail out of here. Like, when you're elk hunting somewhere, you're like, oh, this is a breeze. And then how many people that are involved in that space, or, you know, I guess stakeholders, you would say, that only know nature from a trail.
Mm.
Like, it's a difference between scuba diving and watching fish behavior and free diving. I feel, you know, without the bubbles and noise being clunky, fish just totally act differently.
Right. That's it's a great,
totally different experience.
Great analogy.
And like, I don't think people realize like how different animal behavior is around any areas where they know there's regular human presence.
Mm-hmm.
So you're either going to be in like national parks where they know they can get freebies off of humans. So they're acting, you know, sometimes they're reinforcing people's like Disney,
yeah.
you know, way of looking at animals and really like humanizing their behavior because yeah. they're acting differently because of that trail, or they're just avoiding it. And they're like, there's no animals left. And it's like, no, I should talk to the biologist. Yeah. There's animals left. That's kind of like the problem with a lot of like the reef censuses and surveys that they've done. It's like, there's always the question, like, who's counting these fish? Is it like the college student, you know, that is coming for a marine science degree from Minnesota that just learned how to swim, that's flopping around and scaring the shit out of fish for like, or is it somebody who's knowledgeable and knows how to move in the water and get a good idea and not push fish too hard? You're going to get totally different numbers.
Right. That's funny. I've never thought about that. Yeah, it's a cool time in that, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning of this, that like that you're getting more into hunting and more into hunting brands. I think more people even who don't Hunt are just more interested in this conversation. I was listening to our friend Jake Muse on Tim Ferriss's podcast, and I was so, it like made me fucking tear up the way he was explaining just hunting and conservation, and to have an eloquent speaker like that just deliver this this piece of knowledge that most people just have not really been exposed to, so that all they have are these cliches of hunters, and it's an important thing to do and be able to explain and draw some connection and unity in a time and space where you have these technologies that are so divisive and just continuing to divide us more and more. I think it's just, it's a good conversation for people to enter into who may have differing political beliefs.
Yeah, definitely. And, I guess I should say, like, I don't blame people who don't want to do that at all. Mm-hmm. Like, to be totally honest, like watching videos where there's like the kill shot,
it's hectic.
It's like, it's pretty gnarly. Like, even for me, for someone who hunts, I'm going to watch it because I guess the best way to explain it is like, I don't want to watch a bunch of freaking gory surgeries, but if I'm a surgeon, I want to see what they're doing. I want to learn. I'm interested in the topic from like a very nuts and bolts pragmatic perspective. So that's why like I'm interested in it because of that. But I can totally understand how people would look at that and just be horrified.
Dude, this morning I went and surfed Lonnie's and I opened my door to get out and I crushed a big ass snail.
They're so gross. And it was big African snails.
It was the saddest thing I've ever had. See, I was like, oh God. I was like still kind of quivering. I'm like, oh God, I'm too sensitive for this life. I'm not ready for it.
But that's my point as well, is I also hunt because I'm an animal lover. Mm-hmm. I like that stuff, and I can't kill something that trusts me. And I'm going to eat meat. So I feel like if I'm consistently, eating meat and not participating in any of that process and appreciative of, you're extinguishing a life to feed yourself and your loved ones, I feel like I need to participate in that. Mm. And I just couldn't put a bolt or a bullet in the head of something that's coming to me for food or comfort.
I love that right when you said that, your dog just came up through the window. That was very on cue.
Oh, God. Yeah.
All right. Last thing I wanted to ask you about, for such a practical dude, consciousness. Have you had anything that you would describe as a spiritual experience? And what's the first one that comes to mind?
I've definitely had a lot of that. I do consider myself a spiritual person. I grew up in a, Judeo-Christian family. That's where I get most of my value system, at least the foundation off of that. I think it's a great value system to have. I think it's kind of, I think people try to demonize like Christianity, especially these days. There seems to be like, it's crazy the shit that people can say about it these days. Like, whether it's like the racist stuff that people say, or just like, I was just reading in Canada how many churches, Christian churches, have been burned this year. But
it's pretty benign compared to what it was 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
We've come a long way, people.
But it's like, that foundation, it's, of having somebody or a higher power to answer to be better, to hopefully be operating from a foundation of love and knowing that you're deeply flawed. So who are you to judge? Everybody's out here trying to do their best, hopefully, and try to help other people along, but without being judgmental. So I've always been of that mindset, and just different times in the ocean, and in the mountains, where you're just like, you can feel that energy, and just strange times. Like even when my daughter was born, I knew she was coming, just because of an experience I had in the water. I was like, I got to get in right now.
What was the experience?
My wife was a week past due. I was like, how you feeling, hon? We don't have any fish right now, what if I go run out and spearfish for a couple hours, take the lifeguard rescue board with a spear gun, go out to my place that is kind of like my little happy zone I found when I was younger. Actually, I've had like a few things happen out there that like very much signaled different chapters of my life starting. And it's always been at this place. And I've never, ever seen anybody else dive it. Found it on my own when I was younger. And there's actually a huge cave, like as big as a house. There's always fish in it. And it had collapsed on a giant swell when I got my first closeout set at Waimea. I went back out there and it was surreal. I was like, this feels like the place, but where's the cave? And I realized the swell collapsed this cave that had probably been there for God knows how long. But anyways, I'm out there diving and the current was way stronger than I thought. And all these different reef fish were spawning. Rosie, stop it. So all these different reef fish are spawning, like three different kinds of reef fish. I'd never seen them all spawning at the same time. And this current's just nuking, and I'm having a hard time keeping up. And I just saw all the life that was happening. And I was like, it's happening right now. I know she's coming. And so I get to the beach, get my phone. Of course, there's like a million calls. She's like, my water broke. And we go to the hospital. And, you know, 36 hours or so later, had my daughter. And when she came out, it was the weirdest thing. She came out face down, and she heard my voice. And she turned around and looked me straight in the eyes. Like, I haven't, like, been there for a bunch of births. I didn't know kids had that articulation with their neck when they first come out. And it was the craziest thing. I was like, man, I feel like this is an old soul. Like I felt like I knew her immediately. And then I was thinking, and we didn't settle on her middle name, which was, we wanted it to be a Hawaiian middle name. Like she does have some Hawaiian in her. And so, Ku'u, Jake's wife, I asked, if she could, give my daughter her middle name. And, so I texted Jake.
Ku'u's she's like a Hawaiian historian, right? She knows a lot about the history and is constantly digging up new stuff, right?
Yeah. And she has some special skills, I would say, you know. she definitely is on another level, I think. Anyways, he texted me. He's like, hey man, did you have your baby? And I didn't tell anybody yet. We were just in it. And, I was like, yeah, we did. I think I know what the Hawaiian middle name should mean. And I said, I went out to my spot. You know, this current was very strong. The fish were spawning. And I want it to be something. And I saw her personality type. I'm like, she's been around. This kid's going to do some special things, I think. But pretty much every parent probably thinks that. But I was like, I want it to have the context of the powerful current or a powerful force of nature and current that is required to for life to procreate. So it's not like a negative sense of something that's a strong current. It's that hard and powerful thing that is necessary to propagate life. He's like, oh my God, I'm calling you right now. He's like, so that the reason why I texted you is because Ku had a dream last night that we're in a house on the Big Island in Honokaa, and Kim had your daughter, and she watched your daughter. We all watched her grow up in the span of about 10 seconds. She grew up. And then we opened the door, and when we were outside, the ocean was all just flooding around us. So she already had the name, Keolia Kai Ohua, ready. That was exactly the context that I texted him. Pretty wild.
Mark Healy.
Yeah.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yep. Thank you again, man.
Thank you.
It's always fun talking to you. We got to do another trip or something.
I would absolutely love to. One of the all-time greats. Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.